Hello and welcome back to another episode of Horribly Happy. I'm your host, Jenna.
And I'm your host, Sophie.
And we're back at it again. Sophie's on her last little leg of COVID. How are you feeling, Soph?
I am feeling so much better. Dare I say normal.
Ooh.
Relatively normal. I talked about, well, this is my last day of like my 10-day quarantine.
Yes, you are able to enter the wild tomorrow maskless.
Yes. And last week I talked about how I was going to reach out to my doctor about that antiviral Paxlovid, and I'm just going to make a little pitch for it now. I think you still kind of have to be considered high risk. I have asthma, so I qualified for it. So I was able to get it. It was like a 5-day, twice a day pill thing. And I just want to say after like the first two doses, like the first full day of taking it,
yeah,
I already felt better. Like my sore throat was subsiding. My cough was like almost completely gone, which for someone with asthma, like that's always kind of daunting or worrisome to develop a cough. And it's not lingering or whatever. I think the fatigue was kind of like it's like the most lingering side effect of COVID. And the only side effect I have to say about Paxlovid is that it changes your taste, which is so interesting because COVID can obviously change your taste.
Right.
I think like mostly a lack of taste, but Paxlovid, it was like a bitter metallic taste in your mouth at all times. Like I would wake up in the middle of the night being like, oh my God.
Ew. So like, did you taste that when you took the pill too? Did you totally taste how bad it tasted?
No, like I took the first dose and then like an hour later, I'm like, why does my mouth taste so weird?
Oh.
And I Googled it and it was like, this is a side effects of Paxlovid. So like by the time I would take my next dose, like every 12 hours, it would start to wear off.
Yeah.
But like all my food tasted bad. Like vegetables tasted like especially bad because they're already kind of like bitter.
Right.
I don't know. It was like really gross. Like I got Chipotle one night and I was like, this just doesn't taste good. I got it the day of my last day of pills. And then the next day I had leftovers and I was like, oh my God, this tastes so much better.
That's a strange side effect, but worth it clearly.
Yeah, very much worth it. It was interesting. Like it was like not ideal, but better than, you know, having a lingering COVID.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yes, for sure. And Sophie, you said you probably got it because you are slightly high risk, but I'd like to say that I did hear on a different podcast that there is a surplus of those and not a lot of people know about them. So not a lot of people ask about them. So I'd say if you
ask,
are feeling symptoms, just ask, even if you aren't high risk. I'd say
I just sent my doctor a MyChart message. If people do that outside of Minnesota, I don't know if that's a thing. Chart.
Everybody has my chart.
I don't, whatever. I just sent a little my chart. Like, can I do this? Someone called me, like went through a couple things and they're like, yeah, we'll send it in. Like I didn't even have to go for a formal visit.
Nice. So you did not take, what's the horse thing called?
Oh, I don't know, but no, I didn't take it. Oh, but also the thing about Paxlovid is they recommend you take it within the first 5 days of symptoms. So ask your doctor right away.
Yes. Good PSA.
And that's my pitch.
Ivermectin.
No, I didn't take that.
Okay. So you recommend the antiviral.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to compare to know exactly like how it would have gone if I didn't take it. But all I know is I was feeling worse every single day since the day I had tested. And then the next day after taking that first full day of pills, I felt a lot better. That's so good. I think it helped.
Isn't that lack of energy and fatigue just so crazy?
It is. I still feel like mine was not as bad as yours, but I would take like a nap like every day after work or like during my lunch break because I needed to like regroup, which is actually kind of a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. I didn't take naps because I was nervous I wasn't going to be able to sleep, which like I have zero problem sleeping. So I don't know why I thought that. But I slept until 11 and then I went to bed at like 8. So I was really only up for like minimal hours.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was still going to bed early. And I didn't sleep well, mostly because of my like sore throat. I know you didn't have really a sore throat, but mine was like pretty annoying.
Yeah, that stinks. Well, now you're in the clear for a few months, hopefully. Cross your fingers, knock on wood.
Ready for hot girl summer.
Just in time, baby.
Oh, gosh.
We'll start it up. Let's do it.
Yeah.
The chance is now. But actually, we should start hitting up like the weekend patios and stuff because now that the weather's so nice, it'd be amazing.
Yes. We're out of town this weekend and you've been gone the last two weekends and I've had COVID.
Yeah.
But yeah. The weather has been immaculate.
It's like the seasonal depression veil has been lifted and you're like, oh, like I have a life after 5 p.m. now.
Oh, I'm not a sad sack every day.
Some days still. That's okay. Yeah. So yeah, I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania this past weekend. I've never been. It was beautiful. Actually, though, it was really cool. My friend got married and it was actually Zach's roommate in college. And it was like one of the nicest weddings I've been to. Like just very, very well put together. Very nice details. Very elegant.
And it was like black tie, kind of, pretty much.
It wasn't black tie, but it was like, I think it said formal attire recommended or something like that.
Okay.
So it wasn't like black tie, but it was like dress nice.
Yeah.
It was fun. Well, when we were like before we went to the wedding, the day before we were there early, Zach was in the wedding and we explored Pittsburgh and it was actually like really cool. It's a little bit smaller than Minneapolis, like city-wise, like size, but the downtown area is like, there's a river splitting the downtown apart. It kind of felt Chicago-y, but it was cool. And we had a lot to drink. We had a lot of dancing. When we got back, our flight, so the wedding ended at 11. So, and then we all go back to the hotel bar and everybody's there. I'm like, okay, I have a choice to make because my flight leaves at 6 a.m. the next morning. Do I stay up? Because we're waking up at 3:30 to go to the airport.
Yeah.
And I decided ultimately to go to bed, which I think was the wrong decision. Because you know when you wake up too early and you just feel ill?
Yeah. Like you feel like hungover.
Well, yeah.
Even without drinking. So then on top of drinking, it's like double whammy.
Yes. And I actually like, I had like 5 drinks throughout the evening, which is like not that much, but obviously still a little bit tipsy throughout hours of the night, you know? Yeah. And then, so I was like not feeling great because of that, but also like, I just felt so ill cause it was 3:30 in the morning, but I did go to bed. And then when I woke up at 3:30, there was another wedding at that hotel and the bride was still awake from the other wedding party.
No way.
And they were outside the doors as we were leaving. And it was like a group of them and the bride. It was 4 a.m. at this point. And they are smoking a joint outside 4 a.m. And they're like,
heck yeah,
glaring at us. Because I don't know why. They're just like, they felt like defensive.
Probably like got caught. Yeah.
And they're like, nothing nefarious happening here. And then they like went and hid behind the hotel. I don't know. It was strange, but also interesting choice of the bride because I didn't see the groom anywhere in sight.
That's hilarious. I know. Oh my God.
You know.
Well, I'm glad you had fun. You looked stunning.
Thank you. I went for the slick back hair look and I liked it for a time. And then I got a little bit self-conscious because I'm like, what if people just think I'm sweaty?
You sent us pictures and I think it was very obvious the vibe you were going for.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Like 1,000%.
Okay.
Obvious.
And then I got home and my Stan Lee mug came in the mail. So I was a pretty happy girl.
Waiting for mine. Oh,
you can't see it because my green screen. I'm trying to show Sophie my mug. Oh. So it's on a TikTok trend, or like it's kind of like a Utah influencer trend, right?
Yeah.
Like all these Utah girlies drink their soda pop and their Stanley mug, and it's like a Yeti basically.
Yeah, I mean it's like the Hydro Flask Yeti phenomenon, but specifically Utah girlies, and now all over TikTok. And Jenna and I were unable to snag the 40 ounce, but we got a 30 ounce.
I wanted the 40 ounce in shrub so bad, color shrub. It's like this beautiful green. I wanted it. I signed up for restocks. I was staring at it for 2 weeks. Never was restocked. They're sold out everywhere. So these mugs, it's literally just a stainless steel mug with a handle on it. It's 40 ounces, which is huge. Like, I don't, like, Google it. It's huge.
It is huge.
It has a handle to hold it, but it has a small bottom so you can fit it in your car.
Yeah.
This is also really not bad, but Stanley, if you want to sponsor us.
If you put it in front of your microphone, will it green out? No, yeah. Yeah, and then people are like reselling. Now you're all gone. People are reselling them on eBay.
Yeah,
for an absurd amount of money.
So these are $40 mugs, but they're sold out everywhere on Stanley, Target, REI, like everywhere. These mugs are.
I saw Victoria Paris just found one in Whole Foods. So I think it's like, if you can randomly find them in stock and just like happen upon it somewhere, otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. And the last time they released a new drop, it sold out in hours on the website. So really was vibing for that shrub colored one, but I settled with the cream 30 ounce, which is still huge.
It's I'm excited.
In my head. It's so
I good. Also got the cream, but that's what I would have wanted in the 40 ounce too. So
yeah. I'm still going to get the shrub when it drops.
Oh my God. Of course you are. We wanted to talk about.
Yes. Thank you for that segue.
What's going on in current events of women's rights?
Yeah. We didn't talk about it the last few episodes. And I realized that looking back, we're not scared to get political on this podcast. I think it's pretty clear where we stand, although we are open to hearing everybody else's opinions. So that's also something, but with this issue in particular, we have very strong opinions, and it's been a hard few weeks for us just like processing it. Of course we're talking about the leaked opinion, draft opinion from SCOTUS, talking about the abortion ban. We don't need to get too much into this because we aren't a current events or political podcast, but we do just want to like talk about our feelings a little bit. You know, we do this podcast for some escape, and we're hoping that you all find some escape in the podcast as well. But also we do talk about historical events, and, you know, we didn't want to brush this over. And it's just a sad day for American history, I think. Obviously it's not been passed, or it's not a decision yet, but it's pretty clear where this is headed. So I guess we're just like anxiously pessimistic about our future, sadly. And we support the women's right to choose. Ultimately, if you are against abortion, then don't have one. Mm-hmm. And that's your choice. But ultimately, I think it should be left to the woman whose body it is.
And I think something else I want to point out is that I keep seeing the statistic that 70% of the country is pro-choice, essentially. So it's just like amazing to me that we have such a minority representing this issue right now within the Supreme Court. And that adds like a whole nother layer of like maybe what's wrong in our political system and maybe what needs to be reevaluated.
Yeah, I agree.
But is not the majority of the country that wants to take away a woman's right to their body. And I also just want to say that, like, although this discussion is around abortion and I feel like that's like what everyone's talking about and your right to choose, this actually really has more to do with the right to privacy to a woman, and bodily autonomy.
Yeah.
So by taking down Roe v. Wade, it just like opens up the door for so many other things. And if people are thinking that we're being dramatic by saying that, we're not. And it's true. And it's already happening. So
there's a ton of other decisions that were made on the basis of privacy. And some of those include the right to homosexual marriage, the right to birth control, the right to engage in sexual activity with anybody, any consenting adult.
The right to donate organs, blood, mm-hmm. to people who need that. That is like a lot. That's like the bodily autonomy portion of this. But yes, the privacy, Jenna, 100%. Like what you want to have with a conversation with your doctor is now being taken away. I see cycle tracking apps. People are saying to be wary of that. That is extremely grotesque to me, to be using that to track a woman's cycle. I mean, like, I don't know how true that is, but it's just like, it's something you have to think about.
Yeah. I think also this kind of comes down to people's personal belief on when a life begins. And I'm not going to get into like the details of arguing what I believe. I just more think that anti-abortion activists believe that life begins at conception, and that's a religious belief that they hold. It's not a scientific belief. And there is a separation of church and state for a reason. And that's clearly not being applied in this case, though, because all of the logic for life begins at conception is religious. And that's just like doesn't click in my head. So anyways, we just feel pretty strongly about this because we're two young women. And I think it's, you know,
we are two young women in a blue state. So it's like for us, we probably won't have a large effect initially as this goes through, but it's people like us who need to fight for people who don't have
the that. Impact this will have on poor and Black and Brown communities is going to be devastating.
Yep. Yeah.
And yeah, I saw a tweet that kind of is funny, but also kind of summarizes how I feel about this. It said, interesting to see how they are giving the choice, putting back the power of banning or not banning abortion back to the state. Let's go even smaller. Let's
put
that choice in county's hands or city's hands or even neighborhood's hands or even the woman's hands, the person who has
the individual.
The individual who is experiencing that. It's so interesting to me how some people are like anti-government intruding into people's lives, but then with this issue, they are not. But again, then it goes back to, well, they're protecting the life of the unborn child, but then it goes to, well, when does life begin?
Yeah. Which it's kind of like a cycle of,
yes.
Yep. Yeah. And it's, when does life begin is a philosophical question that probably can't actually ever be answered. And that's why this is like such an ongoing issue. but yeah, I have so much more to say about it. I won't, you know where we stand. And I'm kind of sick of arguing, although get out there and vote.
Yeah. And of course, everybody's entitled to their own beliefs. And I just would advise you as your dear podcast host to look outwards at how this affects not only you and your community, but how it would affect somebody that is in a poor state. Maybe they have two kids already. They literally can't even feed those children. Like, what happens after the birth? You know, like there's no support after the birth.
No.
Anyways, we could go on and on about this.
We really could go on and on. So we should probably stop.
Yeah. Should we get into stories or anything else to talk about?
No, I think that's it. Let's go from a heavy topic to another heavy topic.
Here we go.
Here we go.
I guess you'll never know.
I guess you'll never know.
All right. I'm going to be talking about the 1976 Chowchilla kidnapping. Have you heard about this?
I don't think so.
I'm sure you've listened to a podcast regarding this.
Okay.
Past, because it's like a kind of crazy case. So my sources are Wikipedia.org and CBSNews.com. So the 1976 Chowchilla kidnapping was the abduction of school bus driver and 26 children ages 5 to 14 in Chowchilla, California.
Yes.
In July 15th of 1976. This is crazy. The largest kidnapping in the U.S.
Dang.
At around 4 p.m. on Thursday, July 15th, a school bus driver, Frank Edward, also known as Ed Ray, was driving 26 students of Dairyland Elementary School home from a summer class trip to the Chowchilla Fairgrounds swimming pool when a van blocked the road ahead of the bus. Ray stopped the bus and was confronted by three armed men with nylon stockings covering their faces. Can we just talk about how scary that would be?
I was literally just thinking that.
Ugh.
No, thank you.
One of the men held a gun to Ray while another drove the bus. The third man followed in the van. The kidnappers hid the bus in Barada Slough, a shallow riverbed of the Chowchilla River, where a second van had been parked. So they got rid of the bus and hid it.
Okay. Just the idea of hiding a bus. It's like, quick, let's just hide this whale really quick. It's like, you don't know.
Wait, that's hilarious. That's true. I don't have pictures to see what that looks like.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to like laugh at the situation, but like, quick, where are we going to hide this bus? Anyway.
Panic ensues. Okay. Both vans' back windows were painted black and their interiors were reinforced with paneling. Ray and the children were forced into the two vans at gunpoint and then driven around for 11 hours before taken to a quarry in Livermore, California, 100 miles away. So there's pictures of the van that we'll post, both vans, and it literally looks just like the shantiest prison cell and like the back trunk of it. And yeah, they're in there for 11 hours in a hot van.
Okay, wait. So like they weren't, like their destination wasn't 11 hours away, right? Like they were just like driving around the area for 11 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like, I'm sure people had to relieve themselves. These poor kids probably had to, they're starving. 11 hours.
And scared.
Yeah.
The children— Did I ever tell you, this isn't appropriate, but one time in grade school, I was like hanging out with a friend at her parents' house and then they were driving me home because I was like in second grade, but we had just moved to my new house that is now, we don't live in anymore, but like I had recently moved from my old house to my new house and they forgot the directions. And so they were asking me, but I was like seven. So of course I didn't know. And then at one point I got really quiet and I just said, are you guys kidnapping me? Dead serious. Dead serious. thought they were kidnapping me.
Stop.
They weren't.
What did they say?
They were just like, no. I mean, they were like trying to comfort me. Like, no, we can't remember. Like, we forgot whatever. And I don't know if like they had cell phones. Like, I can't remember.
When you're like 7 years old, maybe
cell phones were around, but like, barely. But people maybe like weren't bringing them everywhere.
Yeah. I remember like the first cell phone my mom and dad had was like an absolute dinosaur.
I actually don't remember my parents' first cell phone. I should ask them about that.
Yeah, it was big.
Like, it looked like a cordless phone.
Yes.
Or then, yeah. Anyway, so I'm not trying to make, but like my 7-year-old self thought I was being kidnapped.
Okay, that actually just reminded me because I was talking about my parents. I saw my dad this weekend briefly, and I was like, or he had just listened to our last episode of our podcast where I was talking about getting hurt all the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's going to happen when I'm 60 years old and like I fall? And he was like, you need to do a formal retraction on the podcast because I'm 60 and that's not old and you're going to be fine when you fall. When
Your dad, who's had the most injuries out of everyone in the family, like, yeah, Mark, you didn't break a hip, but you've broken every other limb on your body. So whatever.
It's not funny at all. It's actually really serious. He like seriously broke his leg. But then a few years later, he was biking and broke both of his arms at the same time.
Yeah, I shouldn't make fight. I shouldn't make light of it. It's Mark. I care about you a lot.
It's not funny, but it's just like ironic coming from him.
Yeah, like he's kind of like, "Hey, I made it to 60 without breaking a hip," but it's like you, like
at what cost?
Anyway, so retracted.
Well, retracted, and I'm glad you weren't kidnapped.
Yeah, same.
The children were herded from the bus into two vans. They were forced to jump from the bus to the vans so that they would not leave behind any footprints. So this was like very well thought out.
Yeah.
Well, kind of.
Kind of.
It was very much planned ahead of time.
Yeah.
There in the early morning of July 16th, the kidnappers forced the victims to climb down a ladder into a buried moving truck that they had stocked with a small amount of food and water and some mattresses. So there's a truck with like a big trunk and it's buried underneath the ground in this Quarry Park area. And it was 12 feet underground.
I mean, like they hit another
truck.
Another truck.
Yeah. Another truck. They were inside an old truck trailer and they had been buried 12 feet underground and air vents were allowing them to breathe. So there was like, it was not a buried alive situation.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it felt like it. And it was very scary and not good conditions at all.
Right.
The children tried to stay calm as the minutes and hours ticked by. After being in the hole for almost 12 hours, conditions started to deteriorate. So 11 hours in the van, 12 hours in the hole. The roof actually started to cave in and they were running out of food. So there's photos of the roof caving in, really scary. So that's obviously a deadly situation.
Yeah.
Ray, the bus driver, and the older children stacked the mattresses so that some of them could reach the opening at the top of the truck, which had been covered with heavy sheets of metal weighing down the heavy sheets of metal was two 100-pound industrial batteries. So that's what was at top, like keeping them in.
Yeah.
After hours of effort, Ray and the oldest boy, 14-year-old Michael Marshall, weighed the lid open with a piece of wood and moved the batteries. Truly, I was scared. I was having a stroke. I'm not kidding. I don't have control over my my words. All right. They then dug away the remainder of the debris blocking the entrance.
Nailed it.
Got it. 16 hours after they had entered the truck, the group emerged and walked to the quarry's guard shack near the Shadow Cliffs Regional Park. They were greeted by stunned workers, and the police were then called. The children and bus driver were then questioned for 4 hours. Like, okay. Obviously, like, they need to question what's going on. The bus driver, for sure.
Hopefully they gave him, like, food and water.
They did, but, like, they were driving around for 11 hours, they were in the truck for 16 hours, and then they're questioned for 4 hours. Like,
and, like, God. As an adult, I can, like, understand, like, why that needs to happen, but as a kid,
yeah,
like, oh, and my gosh.
Kids. 14 yeah. was the oldest kid.
Yeah.
At 14, I'd be bawling my eyes out.
Yeah. Duh.
At 27, I'd be bawling my eyes out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So finally, after escaping and 4 hours after interviewing, the children boarded yet another bus, but this time it was headed back home to Chowchilla because they were in Livermore. Yes, okay. Livermore, California, 100 miles away. So they had to board another bus to go home.
Traumatizing.
I know. Finally, they got home and they were greeted by family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, police started to dig for clues at the scene of the crime. The quarry owner's son, 24-year-old Frederick Newhall Woods IV, I believe. I'm not very good at Roman numerals.
Oh. Okay. Is it 1X?
It's 1V.
I mean 1V. Yeah, that's the fourth.
Okay. See, it's confusing. Quickly, it came under... Okay, so Newhall Woods quickly came under suspicion as one of the people who had keys to the quarry and had enough access to have buried the moving truck there. He and two friends, brothers, James and Richard Schoenfeld, aged 24 and 22 respectively, had previously been convicted of motor vehicle theft, for which they had been sentenced to prohibition. No. For which they had been
probation.
Probation.
I was like, something doesn't sound right. No alcohol. No.
They were sentenced to probation for the vehicle theft. A warrant was executed on the estate of the Woods father, and their police recovered one of the guns used in the kidnapping, as well as a draft of a ransom note that the three men had wrote. Woods was caught 2 weeks after the kidnapping in Vancouver, and James had been captured earlier the same day in California, while Richard, the other brother, was voluntarily turned himself into authorities 8 days after the kidnapping. So this is when I was like, it was planned ahead and it was smart. I was like, well, not really smart, because the kidnappers had been unable to call in their intended ransom demand of $5 million, which is equivalent to $23.8 million today, because telephone lines in Chowchilla Police Department were tied up by media calls and families searching for their children. So they,
oh gosh,
they kidnapped everybody with an intended ransom of a shit ton of money, and they were unable to call in their ransom.
Nice.
Okay. Like, it's not funny, but it's, like, so idiotic.
Yeah.
So they went to sleep because they couldn't call in their ransom at some point on July 16th, and woke up later that night to television news reports informing them that the victims had freed themselves and were safe.
They're probably like, oh, crap.
Like, I'm not trying to make this situation, but it's, like, so shocking. It's, like, funny. It's, like, it's not funny, but it, you know what I mean. It's, like, I can't help but to laugh.
It's ironic. Yes. Like, you're failing at this.
You butchered this.
Yeah.
So James Schoenfeld later stated that despite coming from wealthy families, both he and Woods were deeply in debt. We needed multiple victims to get multiple millions, and we picked children because children are precious. The state would be willing to pay ransom for them, and they don't fight back. They're vulnerable, and they will mind. Which is, like, so gross.
Yep.
I mean, nobody would be good to take, but that is so traumatizing, and
it's hard because children are so innocent.
They're so innocent.
So it's, like, it's just especially bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed. So some details of the crime corresponded to details in The Day the Children Vanished, which was a story by Hugh Pentecost, and was published in 1969. A copy of this book was in the Chowchilla Public Library, and police theorized that it had inspired the kidnappers because it had eerie similarities to that book.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's like somewhat common in some of these like crazy cases. Like they pull from inspiration, quote unquote.
Oh, for sure. And like some people take like real life events. Some people might take fiction.
Yeah.
Either way, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
All three perpetrators pled guilty to kidnapping for ransom and robbery, but they refused to plead guilty to infliction of bodily harm, as a conviction on that count in conjunction with the kidnapping charge counted as a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. So they pleaded not guilty to that. They were tried on the bodily harm charge, found guilty, and given the mandatory sentence, but their convictions were then later overturned by an appellate court, which found that physical injuries sustained by the children, mostly cuts and bruises, did not meet the standard of law for bodily harm under the law. Just, like, disappointing.
Only because it didn't... It's just, like, it's so fascinating to me. It's, like, how attempted murder is, yes, like, charged less than actual murder. It's, like, yeah, hey, just because you, quote-unquote, sucked at it,
right,
oh, you don't have to get as bad just of a sentence.
These were the worst kidnappers in the world.
Like, their intent was...
And they could have killed them. The roof was caving in. If they would have, yes, continued to sleep and the children and bus driver did not dig themselves out, the roof would have caved in.
Yeah.
Like, that is terrifying.
Or even, like, starvation, dehydration, like,
yes,
so many things.
They were resentenced to life with the possibility of parole after that. And unfortunately, Richard was released in 2012 and James was released in 2015. Oh, Richard was released in 2012 and James was paroled in August of 2015. I wonder, I don't know the details on that. Those are the two brothers. Then in October 2019, Woods, that's who was the son of the quarry owner, yeah, was denied parole for the 19th time. Over the years, reasons given for the denials have included his continued minimization of his crime, as well as disciplinary infractions for possession of contraband, pornography, and cell phones, which is like, his minimization of the crime is like so disheartening. Like,
yeah, that's the worst part of all that.
In 2016, a workers' compensation lawsuit filed against Wood also revealed that he had been running several businesses, including a gold mine and a car dealership, from behind bars without notifying prison authorities.
How? Interesting.
Well, he had cell phones.
Yeah, yeah. The wow, this guy is trouble.
I know. The heir to two wealthy California families, the Newhalls and the Woodses. This is Woods who I'm talking about right now.
Yeah.
He inherited a trust fund from his parents that was described in one court filing as being worth $100 million. Yeah. Although Woods' lawyers disputed the amount, so it's not confirmed how much it was worth. He was also married three times while in prison and purchased a mansion about 30 minutes away from the prison. Like, okay. In March of 2022, a panel of two commissioners recommended Woods for parole. The recommendation required the approval of the full parole board, the board's legal division, and California's governor. So he's been recommended for parole, but he hasn't been granted it yet.
This guy is trouble. Like, even if it's not like involving kids again or even kidnapping, like, he's bad news.
He's up to some nefarious acts.
Yes.
And I'm not happy about it.
Keep him.
So Frank Edward Ed Ray, who was the bus driver, who was born in 1921, died in 2012, but he received a California School Employees Association citation for outstanding community service before he died in 2012.
Yeah.
Before he died, he was also visited by many of the school children that he helped save. which like tugs at my heartstrings.
Yeah.
In 2015, the Sports and Leisure Park in Chowchilla was renamed the Edward Ray Park, and every February 26th was declared Edward Ray Day in Chowchilla.
Cute.
Which is so sweet.
That is so sweet.
A study done found the kidnapped children suffered from panic attacks, nightmares, nightmares involving kidnappings and death, and personality changes. Like, of course.
Yeah. How could yeah, they that not? Makes sense.
Many developed fears such as, or for things such as cars, the dark, the wind, the kitchen, mice, dogs, and hippies.
Hmm.
Which is just, I don't know why the hippies part, but like, it then goes on to say one of the kids shot a Japanese tourist with a BB gun when the tourist car broke down in front of his home.
Oh, wow.
Just like, kind of weird.
Yeah, weird association.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many of the children continued to report symptoms of trauma for at least 25 years after the kidnapping, including substance abuse, depression, and a number have been imprisoned for doing something controlling to someone else.
That's heartbreaking.
I know. What was learned from the after effects suffered by the kidnapped children has guided the treatment of young victims of trauma since the kidnapping. In 2016, the 25 surviving kidnapped children settled a lawsuit they had filed against kidnappers. The money they received was paid out of Frederick Wood's trust fund, and although the exact settlement amount was not disclosed, one stated that they had received enough to pay for some serious therapy, but not enough for a house. And that's the story of the Chowchilla bus kidnapping. Crazy. I mean, here there's so many long-lasting effects of trauma, but it's interesting and sad and devastating to see it play out in this case.
Yeah.
And, you know, although nobody actually died, it still is clearly, like, life-altering for everybody involved.
Yeah. It's, like, the whole story is super sad and traumatic for the kids, and then just, like, hearing about how it affected them moving forward is also just so sad and disheartening. I think like oftentimes you hear these stories and then you're like, oh, but they were saved. No one was hurt.
Nobody was hurt. They all survived. It's a survival story, but at a cost.
There's the trauma. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I've definitely heard that before, but like forgot a lot of the details.
Me too.
I'm glad you retold it.
Yeah. It's freaking wild. Like,
it is crazy.
Some of the most intricate, detailed, but also dumbest kidnappers ever.
Yeah.
And at like such a stupid cost. Like they all came from wealthy families.
$5 million isn't even like a drop in your $100 million trust fund. Like,
yeah, exactly. Well, it's $100 million in today's money.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure his trust fund was less then, because $5 million back then is worth a lot more now.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. But, okay, regardless. Well,
regardless, it's so stupid.
He had a trust fund.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah.
Stupid.
I know.
Well, good retelling. That was interesting.
Thank you, thank you.
I never really know what to say at the end of these, like, bummer.
Super bummer.
Yeah. Yeah, thank God we end on a happy note, right?
Right. That's why we're here.
That's why we're here. Are you ready for my story?
I am.
Okay. So I am telling the story of Jonas Salk and his contribution to modern medicine.
Why does that name sound so familiar?
Same. I was like, this name sounds so familiar. Like, I've obviously heard it before, and I think it's just because people refer to him because he's got such a great... His contribution to modern medicine is amazing. So I think it's just been, like, he's, like, a reference point of, like, Oprah Winfrey, Jonas Salk. Like, people will just say that. But my only source this week is Wikipedia.
Has Oprah Winfrey been a big contributor to modern medicine?
No, but she... I didn't know this because I was maybe going to do her, which I need to look into her more, but she like just created, she's a success story. Like she came from nothing and like poverty. And I think she's just like, she has nothing to do with modern medicine herself, but she, I think, is a overall good person who's probably done a lot with like donations.
Got it. So you're just saying like Jonah Salk, Oprah Winfrey,
inspiration
in history.
Yeah. Of inspirational people mostly.
I was thinking you meant like equivalent achievements.
No. Yeah. Good clarification. Oprah Winfrey is not in the medicinal field. Okay. So quick background. Jonas Salk was born in New York City to Daniel and Dora Salk and had two younger brothers, Herman and Lee. At the age of 13, Salk entered Townsend Harris High School, which was a public school for the intellectually gifted students. Salk was known as a perfectionist who read everything he could lay his hands on in high school. That's how he was described. So after high school, he enrolled in CCNY, City College of New York, where he graduated with a degree in chemistry in 1934. And he actually originally wanted to become a lawyer, but his mother pushed him to consider medical school, which he eventually enrolled in. He attended New York University to study medicine. However, Salk decided he did not want to practice medicine after his time in grad school, and he actually became so absorbed in research that he even took a year off of biochemistry. Took a year off to study biochemistry, which like obviously is still like, it's still medical, but he was like way more into the research side of things than like practicing medicine.
Got it. So kind of like Elizabeth Holmes type.
Sure. Dude, get her out of your head.
My queen. She will never leave my head.
He took a year off to study biochemistry, but he did not drop out of school.
Got it. Okay.
So, but he did eventually pivot his studies to bacteriology. So he stayed in grad school. So he stayed with his degree in medicine.
Wait, okay. Can I guess?
What? No.
Oh.
Okay. But I feel like I've talked about that.
Keep going then.
Okay. So he eventually pivoted his studies to bacteriology, and he stayed with his degree in medicine versus pursuing a PhD in biochemistry because, as he states, quote, "I believe that this is all linked to my original ambition or desire, which was to be of some help to humankind, so to speak, in a larger sense than just a one-on-one basis," unquote. Now I'm going to get into his research and successes. In 1941, during his postgrad work in virology, Salk chose a two-month elective to work in the Thomas Francis's lab at the University of Michigan. Francis had recently discovered the type B influenza virus. And once Salk graduated, he began his residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, where he worked with Francis again. And eventually the two of them perfected a vaccine that was soon widely used at army bases for influenza. So they helped develop this influenza vaccine.
Okay. Wow.
And I don't know if it's like the flu vaccine we see today, or if it was like a specific strain, like influenza B.
Right.
And then in 1947, Salk wanted his own lab and was eventually granted one at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. That's kind of fun. You were just there.
Shout out.
Hey.
Go Steelers.
Yeah. So.
Go Pirates.
Okay. In 1948, Harry Weaver, the director of research at the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, contacted Salk. He asked him to find out if there was more types of polio than the three then known. Salk spent the next year gathering supplies, researchers, and funding. And he later joined the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis's Polio Project, established by President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Nice.
Yeah. And then, so on July 2nd of 1952, so what, let me see here. He was reached out to in 1948. So July 2nd of 1952, after successful tests on lab animals, Salk injected 43 children with his killed virus vaccine.
Mm.
Killed polio virus vaccine.
Right.
A few weeks later, he injected children at the Polk State School for the retarded and feeble-minded. And then he vaccinated his own children in 1953. And in 1954, he tested the vaccine on about 1 million children known as polio pioneers.
Wow. First of all, that name is very outdated.
What?
The R word?
Oh, retarded and feeble-minded. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. It is outdated. That was just...
No, I know, but I just feel like it's hard. I don't want to gloss over that. And
it feels wrong to say.
Yeah. Okay, I was going to say, like, I heard the inventor of the polio vaccine tested on his children first. So is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So, like, it's important to know July 2nd, 1952, after it was successful in labs, like, lab animals, it was still in testing. So even though he did inject it into children for the first time, it was still technically in the trials. So yeah, he did 43 children. Then he did some school children, then his own children, and then again on 1 million children. And they were known as the polio pioneers.
Wow. Wild.
Which I'm kind of like, if you are comfortable enough injecting your own kids with your vaccine, I would think you probably feel confident in it.
Yeah.
The vaccine was announced safe on April 12, 1955. The project was very large and involved 100 million contributions to the March of Dimes and 7 million volunteers.
1955. Was there a vaccine for polio before that?
No, because my grandpa had polio.
I mean, that's just crazy because my dad was born in 1961. So obviously it was before that. But I just feel like polio was taken care of way before his time, but clearly not.
So look, so in 1954, he tested the vaccine on about 1 million children known as polio pioneers. So I guess like it wasn't maybe officially FDA approved as we would know it today, but sounds like a lot of kids were getting it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And just to kind of go into more detail about how huge this program was, it involved 20,000 physicians and public health officers, 64,000 school personnel, and 220,000 volunteers. There were also over 1.8 million school children participating in the trial. And a 1954 Gallup poll showed that more Americans knew about the polio field trials than could give the full name of the president.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was a big thing, which I believe it was mania, I'm sure. All these kids were dying from polio.
Right.
And my grandpa had polio and survived. Like, he had a very minor case, but he has like some issues now in his legs or his knees that they think is attributed to when he had polio.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, kind of interesting.
It makes me think, like, what's going to happen 50 years from now with COVID? Like, the lasting effects of that.
Yeah, it's kind of scary to think about.
I know.
Like, especially people who, like, lost their sense of taste and smell or who have long COVID and...
Yeah.
Heart problems and stuff. I'm vaccinated though, so hopefully that helps.
Knock on wood.
Yeah. So the foundation allowed itself to go into debt to finance the final research required to develop the Salk vaccine, for which he worked incessantly on for 2.5 years. So obviously this was like number one priority, which again, like I get going back to like kids were dying. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids were dying. So I think this was like huge priority. His vaccine is now on the World Health Organization list of essential medicine. And when TV personality Ed Murrow asked Salk who owned the patent, Salk replied, quote, "Well, the people, I would say, There is no patent. Could you patent the sun? Unquote. The vaccine was calculated to be worth $7 billion had it been patented. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
But like, so cool that he didn't.
Yeah.
Do that. Like, I mean, we even saw that with the COVID vaccine. Like, everything was patented, but.
Right. Isn't there one that's not patented? Or one that's mass produced and was the patent shared with a bunch? I think maybe. It's AstraZeneca.
Oh, okay.
Anyways.
I think you're right. So Sok became a public figure overnight, and although he was adored by many, he preferred his privacy and individuality. And there's even a quote of something along the lines of him being like, as a scientist, like, I obviously don't love attention from people. Which is true.
Can't relate.
So true, Jenna. Truer words have never been spoken. But me too, it's fine. So he did receive a number of awards and recognition, such as Presidential Citation, 4 honorary degrees, 6 foreign decorations, and letters from thousands of citizens. Years after Salk's discovery, the Salk Institute for Biological Studies opened in 1963 in the San Diego neighborhood of La Jolla, which I feel like the Salk Institute is something I've heard, and I feel like maybe that's where you heard that name. Salk believed that the institution would help new and upcoming scientists along with their careers. He stated, quote, I thought how nice it would be if a place like this existed and I was invited to work there, unquote. Salk passed away from heart failure at the age of 80 on June 23rd, 1995 in La Jolla. And I just want to end with some closing words by him. Salk had once mentioned to his cousin that he was optimistic that ways to prevent most human and animal diseases could eventually be developed. Salk said people must be prepared to take prudent risks, since a risk-free society would become a dead-end society without progress. Mm. And I just feel like those are powerful words. And in the light of what we're going through now and with the COVID vaccine, and just like the hesitancy with vaccines. And I think the issue with people not trusting scientists and people whose job it is to develop these vaccines, you know, it's something to remember that like we are here today because of people like this. Like, people were giving their 1.8 million kids during a trial.
Yeah.
No one would, people think it's abuse to put their kids through trials right now. And without them, without these polio pioneers, where would we be today?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point.
So, now I'm not saying that it's like, just do whatever to your kid, whatever is like ever said to you, whatever, right. Like talk to your doctor, get informed, trust scientists. It's okay to get second, third, fourth opinions if you feel like that's what you need, 100%. But also, it's science, and it is not your job to understand science. Like, that's why we have scientists.
Yes. Very well said, Sophie. And super fascinating background. I like, he sounded so familiar, and I've like heard about the polio vaccine origins.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so interesting hearing the whole backstory.
Yeah. And he went on to help with a lot of other vaccines. I just did the polio. So that's, you've probably heard his name from other things too, but the polio vaccine was like his vaccine. So yeah. I think that's what he is most known for.
Good for him and humanity.
Yeah. In modern medicine, which I think not everything needs to be treated with modern medicine, but it's something I think a lot of people take for granted, and I'm thankful for.
Totally. Me too. Well, I'm thankful for you.
Okay.
I'm thankful you're feeling better. I'm thankful for our listeners. I'm thankful for everybody who subscribes, rates, reviews, shares with a friend.
Smash that subscribe button.
Smash that subscribe button. You know what? Get vaccinated if you're able to. And have a great week.
Stay healthy.
Stay healthy. Stay happy. Wait, that's the wrong outro. Have a great week. We love you. Wait,
and what stay happy.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's all you say.
We love you. Have a great week and stay happy.
As happy as you can be.
Bye.
Bye.